Good morning, 8-11 here on the Mighty 690. As we go throughout a Wednesday, it's time to continue our chat with folks from Key State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. With us, we have Adavin Skrantz, Diversified Agriculture and Natural Resources Agent. How are you doing, Adavin?
Doing good, thank you. How are you?
Doing good, thank you. So do you have any official baking or cooking duties this Thanksgiving?
No, well, not really. My duty's pretty easy. So every year in our garden, we grow a pretty big patch of sweet corn.
Nice.
And part of that we leave on the, you know, cob for roasting ears. And then a good chunk of that we also take off the cob and store in the freezer. So all I have to do is remember to pull the bag of corn out of the freezer today to get that thawed out and ready for Thanksgiving dinner.
And isn't the time from picking to freezing pretty critical because it starts getting less sweet, right?
Yeah, so you definitely want to, you know, pick that sweet corn as, you know, as soon as it's ripe, like ready to go. And this batch of sweet corn, we actually picked a little bit later. It still tastes really good, is nice and fresh. But so usually you're battling the raccoons to get to the sweet corn.
Yep.
They find out it's ready to go faster than you do. And then you're missing quite a bit of sweet corn in your patch. But this year we actually had the neighbor dogs kind of run around and come down to visit. And they kept the raccoons out of the sweet corn patch for us. So we actually didn't think it was quite ready to go yet because we hadn't seen any raccoons in there, any signs of them. It was ready to go. So yeah, picking it at the correct time and not letting it get overripe is important. And then we pick it and process it that day. So it's a full day.
Nice. Well, speaking of raccoons, we have more to talk about with pets coming up here, but you do have some events on the way, correct?
Yes, I have a couple of events I want to talk about. You know, starting not so much in December, we kind of get past the holidays, but then January and February are really busy months for us programming wise because it's the time of year that is typically the slowest time of year for farmers and ranchers. You know, it does get busier the later on in the spring with planting, and then usually producers, their cows will start calving sometime in that February to March area. But we try to take advantage of this slower time to plan some programs for folks to attend. And the first one is actually a statewide led program. It will be December 13th, and it is the Farm and Ranch Transition Conference. And folks may have already heard a lot about this. We've been talking about it and trying to advertise, get the word out about it. This is a fairly new program. It's actually a department that is through the Ag Economics Department, through a grant they got, the Ag Transitions Office, kind of a play on words there. But in December, they're doing three of these programs, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, all throughout Kansas. So they'll start in Colby, go to Salina, and then the one in Erie, so in the southeast part of Kansas, is December 15th. This is an all-day program. It starts at 8:30 and goes through 3 in the afternoon, but they will be serving you lunch and have some snacks there at morning registration. The keynote speaker for this program is Dr. Farrell from Oklahoma State University. He's an ag law professor there, but he grew up in a farming family and his family still actively farms. So this is something he has firsthand knowledge about as well. And then there'll also be another lawyer speaking on it in the afternoon, which I think will be more of like the ins and outs of, you know, the whole paperwork legal side of it. And then there'll also be a panel discussion where folks who have been through the process can speak on their recommendations and experiences So registration for this program is at $60, and then the registration deadline is December 1st, so it's coming up pretty fast. And to register for this program, you'll actually do it through a website or by emailing them, but you can give us a call at the extension office, and we can send you that link, provide you with all that information. And then the second program is coming up. We'll start on January 18th. This will be a four-part series. It's titled The Power of Negotiation and Communication, but it will be a series on land lease strategies, and this will cover the basics of lease agreements, landlord-tenant relationships, negotiation and communication skills, and then conservation practices as well. So a lot of farmers and cattle producers, you know, rent quite a bit of their land. So this is an important topic. We always get a lot of questions on it. And this is open for everyone. The grant they got is to target different programs like this for women in ag, but men are welcome to attend too. And we're going to be hosting this program in three locations in our district. So it'll be in Neodesha, Edna, Cherokee, and then it will also be held in Erie. The Southwind District is hosting that program. So this is a $50 registration fee. It will be January 18th, 25th, and then February 1st and February 8th, which are all Wednesdays. It will start at 5:30 and go until about 8. Dinner is provided at this event. And then this is actually a statewide program, and K-State partnered with Nebraska and Purdue University. So they'll have some really good speakers coming in, and then we'll also be talking about specifics to Kansas and the local area as well during these programs. So if folks have any questions, want to register for this, again, they can call our office at 620-331-2690.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like some really good opportunities coming up, educational and get meals involved and that sort of thing. So make a day of it. So good deal. So I know as we get closer to, you know, it's cold outside, that sort of thing. We have all sorts of pests trying to make their way into warmth.
Yes.
And that does include mice, right?
Yes. So mice are a big one as it gets colder outside. You know, everyone and all the critters are looking for someplace warm to go in the winter. And well, folks are probably preparing for Thanksgiving and to have a lot of company over. Mice probably aren't the guests they have in mind.
Right?
So a couple precautions that you can take to maybe avoid a mouse in your home is just walking around both the inside and outside of your house and looking for any small holes or cracks that mice can fit through. They can fit through some pretty small areas, and then patching those holes and cracks or filling them with something depending on where they're at in your home. There's a bunch of different options on how to do that. You can use spray foam, caulking, you know, wood to patch it, or whatever material the siding of your house is. In some areas, you can also use steel wool to just kind of fill that in maybe a less temporary fix. But that's the main thing, is to walk around and make sure all those small holes and tiny cracks are filled in. You know, I talk about this, and then I actually had a mouse get into my house, and I knew they could fit through very small areas, but it was actually fitting through just a very, very, very small crack between my front door and that door jamb.
Yep,
you know,
yep.
Small enough I could just fill it in with some caulking. It was so small you couldn't even really fully patch it. So they're pretty clever, pretty smart about just finding any nook and cranny they can fit in. And if you do get a mouse in your home, there's a lot of different options nowadays for traps. There's, of course, the sticky traps, the traditional traps, there's also some other styles of traps now that, you know, are lethal, but the mouse kind of, you know, goes into them and then they're caught. And then when it comes to baiting those mouse traps, of course, kind of the stereotypical one you always see in cartoons is that piece of cheese, but peanut butter also yep. works really well, and it's harder for the mouse to get off the trap without, you know, taking the bait but not getting caught in the trap. And there's also baits and poisons you can use as well. You just want to be cautious when you're using those, because if any other animals eat that mouse that died from that poison, that can make them sick as well. So especially if you yourself have cats or dogs around, that's probably not an option you want to go with. Cats, of course, are another option to keep mice away.
And you know, I've seen chickens eat mice before too, but chickens are less susceptible to poisons, it seems like. I don't know what that would do to a chicken if they had a mouse that had eaten something.
Yeah, chickens are pretty small, so it would be harmful for them.
Sure.
For them too. And chickens, although they are omnivores and will eat meat, so will eat mouse, they're probably not as likely to eat one.
I've seen them several times.
They
would get into the hen house and they would get the mouse, and once they were done with it, it was two-dimensional. I mean, all that was left was the skin. You could just pick it up and it was like a piece of paper, just choop, choop. So I've seen this happen several times.
Interesting. Yep. So the other thing along with that of them getting in the hen house is they're also after any easy sources of food. So keeping any cat food, dog food, even grains, any scratch you have for your chickens or your other livestock in containers that are well sealed that mice can't really get into is another way to reduce them around your home. And that also goes for other critters like raccoons and possums and even skunks as well. As to any type of pet food, keep it in a secure container, and if possible, don't leave pet food sitting out for your dog or cat to eat all day, because then raccoons discover that it's an easy source of food as well. And I've also gotten a couple calls from folks about a skunk taking up residence under their porch, which of course really isn't something you want hanging around. And then also reducing the amount of cover. So if you have any bushes around your house, that provides shelter that those animals like as well. So keeping that trimmed up, keeping the leaves picked up. Of course, I know around my house, all the trees have lost their leaves and there's a lot of dead leaves blowing around. So keeping those picked up. And then if you have any kind of piles from trimming trees or those bushes in your planter, if you're able to move those and wood piles as well farther away from your house, that will also help reduce mice and other critters taking up residence in your house or close to your house.
Sure. And they're always talking about this in the broadcasting trade magazines from transmitter buildings, you know, because we don't want mice in electronics. So
Yes. They
say, you know, if you got like maybe a shed or something to be similar, go in there, turn out the lights and look for light coming in. That's how I'll help you find the cracks. And that spray foam, just like you said, sometimes you stuff the crack with stainless steel wool. That'll last longer. And then do the spray foam. So just kind of combining a couple things we talked about.
Yeah, no, that's a great tip, is combine both of them, make it, you know, even more mouse-proof. Yep,
they'll actually eat the spray foam eventually. It'll take a while, but they eat all sorts of weird stuff. I'm like, how do they do that?
how do they eat that and survive? But nope, they're pretty crafty when it comes to making their way in.
The classic car guys will swear by fresh cab. I don't know if you've ever encountered that. I haven't seen it for sale more here. It's more the northern states, but it's kind of a pine smelling. It smells really good. People put it in their trunks. They put it in their engine compartments if they're storing a car, that sort of thing. And it's, or generator compartments, that sort of thing. And it supposedly wards off mites.
Yeah,
I don't know.
So I know my boyfriend's family, they farm, and their grain trucks, you know, they're parked for the winter, won't really pull them out again until wheat harvest in the spring. So they put bars of Irish Spring soap
in the cab,
and it does the same type of thing, helps prevent mice. And then also If you're able to store those trucks under, you know, a roof where they're out of the weather, popping the hood on them so pack rats can't get in and build a home. So you also want to be aware, like you're saying, of mice in sheds, garages, getting into any vehicles that will be parked and sitting for a while, or other places they'll look to go to.
And if you see, of course, evidence of mice, you know, mouse poop, the nest building, that sort of thing, that may be a sign that you need to be setting some traps and checking.
Yeah. Another thing, this is more out in the desert where water isn't as common, but mice are a problem in, you know, the shop. My dad has a maintenance station for the road crew out there. And one of the things they've done, and that other people do as well, is you can also catch them in a bucket by putting a little bit of water down low because they're looking for that water. Here, water's a lot more common than it is in the desert.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And what we've also done in some property we have, it's basically a trailer that was only used a couple times a year. Get a 5-gallon bucket. You put a roller in the middle there, antifreeze in the bucket, a yardstick for them to get up to it, and then coat the middle section of the roller. You have to make sure the dowel can spin, a pretty big dowel, an inch and a half. And then so they'll crawl out on the roller, they'll try to reach the bottom side of the peanut butter, it'll spin, they fall in the antifreeze, there's no smell. If you have a property you only use a couple times a year,
you don't want to come back and
we'll have
that
12 to 20 mice in there every time. So there's so many cool tricks that people come up with, but you know, it's a fascinating topic. I think pest control is one of my hobbies, which is weird. I'm just like, what the heck? I'm always like at war, but you know, man and mice. Other topic we wanted to just quick touch on as we head towards the bottom of the hour. You mentioned about wheat production.
Yeah. So kind of touching, tying in a little bit with Thanksgiving. Of course, one of the main things about Thanksgiving, of course, is being with your friends and your family, but also the Thanksgiving meal and bread for stuffing or rolls to go along with dinner are one of the main things for Thanksgiving as one of the side dishes. So to tie in with that, of course, Kansas as a state is known for their wheat production. We're really big producers of wheat, one of the top states for that. And then I just wanted to highlight this area of Kansas. So the Wildcat District is Montgomery, Wilson, Labette, and Crawford County. And last year, for Kansas Ag Week or Ag Month, I went through and kind of took the USDA reports and totaled up how much wheat is produced in our little area in Kansas. And last year, so acres harvested for wheat was just a little bit over 52,000 acres is what was harvested for wheat. And then those acres produced 2,263 bushels of wheat produced. So we produced over 2 million bushels of wheat in this area of Kansas. And then just to kind of give you an idea, so a 60-pound bushel of wheat makes roughly 42 pounds of white flour, and that's enough to make 70 one-pound loaves of white bread. So that's just some facts I thought were kind of cool as you're sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner. You know, Kansas is a big wheat producer, and that's one way to kind of tie ag into that Thanksgiving dinner. And of course, you know, there's a lot of cool ag facts out there. One I find interesting is I like cranberry sauce, and Wisconsin was one of the leading states for cranberry production. So just a ag fact I thought was kind of interesting and wanted to share.
No, because I know like Michigan, Wisconsin, maybe Ohio, that's kind of where they have those cranberry bogs and everything where you like flood them. And I'm just like, wow, that's wild to harvest.
Yeah.
But that's interesting on the wheat because, you know, we don't necessarily always think of Southeast Kansas as being the best for agriculture as far as wheat production. We're thinking about, you know, South Central Kansas and Western Kansas and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so this area of Kansas are big producers of wheat. So winter wheat is one of the main crops here. So winter wheat was planted, you know, just a few months ago. Some folks are out I'm still planting it. Just a couple days ago, I saw some farmers drilling wheat. But so that's what you'll actually see growing in the fields right now. And then they'll harvest it in about middle to end of June. They'll harvest that wheat.
Out there on the east side of town where I live, I walk around and I can see the deer are already munching it up.
Yes.
You know, they're going, they're having a field day. There's more, of course, they're not going to make any difference in it. But they're having a good time.
Yeah, no, the deer love it as well.
It was like, I saw six of them out there just right, all clumped together. And I'm like, man, they're just going at it.
Yeah, we were driving around the other evening and we were passing wheat fields and seeing, you know, half a dozen to a dozen deer out in different fields grazing on it.
Yep, they are enjoying themselves. Well, David, this has been great. I always enjoy our chats as always, and I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, thank you, and look forward to chatting you with you the next time. So we will continue here on Open Liner in Mighty 690, and we do have coming up at 9:10 the Coffeyville Chamber, but we'll have an early bird edition of Open Line on the way here on the Mighty 690.